Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Help me out here. TFT has the industry's broadest line of fire suppression equipment, yet everyone thinks we're just nozzles. Sure, we've got all the fixed, selectable, and automatic handheld nozzles you'd ever want, but we also have great foam injection and application equipment, amazing manual and remote control monitors, high-flowing intake valves, and leak-proof suction hose. So if you're specking a new apparatus, go to www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686. TFT makes over 2,300 products. We're not just nozzles anymore.
Hello and welcome to the Apparatus Architects here on Radio at Firehouse.com. Your hosts are Michael Wilbur and Tom Shand. The show covers a little bit of everything in the apparatus field, and as you'll listen to today, you'll hear there was many, many incidents in recent times involving apparatus accidents and other incidents of apparatus leaving without drivers in place. Some other apparatus industry news. So without further delay, welcome to Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand, the Apparatus Architects.
Good morning, everybody. This is Mike Wilbur here.
Tom Shand, and we're very pleased to have you folks listening into the program today. As Peter indicated, it's almost like the more time you spend here in the business and the brotherhood with the fire service, where you think you have either read it all or experienced it all, something else comes along, a story that just tops it. And one of my favorite expressions would be, you'd think you'd be walking into the nonfiction section, and some would say, nope, that this is absolutely true. The book's going to be here on the shelf. So with that, Brother Mike, what are a couple of the things that have struck you here that have happened in the last 30 to 45 days, that things we just want to talk about a little bit?
The first I have, Tom, is the pumper in the state of Florida that was evidently not braked, did not have the parking brake on, did not have any wheel chocks, and as a brother firefighter left the truck, it rolled out of the station across the street and ended up in a lake as the firefighter was trying to chase it down. Another significant topic, budget cuts. A front axle snapped on an Ohio fire apparatus en route to a working fire where their maintenance budget was slashed. We have an apparatus rollover due to brake failure that occurred at the beginning of the month. They were going down 7 to 8% grade. The brakes gave out. The truck was equipped with air brakes. The driver lost the brakes at the intersection. He attempted to make a turn, and he rolled the truck. Both firefighters, however, were wearing seatbelts, thank God. And then we have just a litany of litigation surrounding emergency vehicle wrecks. First, we take you to Ohio again, where an ambulance driver in a fatal crash was charged with failure to stop. The ambulance driver had slowed down but failed to cautiously enter a rural intersection where the emergency vehicle struck a semi-trailer, caused a fiery crash that killed the driver and four others. It happened about 65 miles southwest of Toledo. A volunteer firefighter was charged in a fatal responding crash. That was earlier this week in Ontario, Canada. A volunteer firefighter has been charged with dangerous driving and criminal negligence causing the death after he struck and killed a civilian with his car in September. He was responding to the scene of a single car crash. The civilian was already on scene helping the 19-year-old hurt in a crash when this firefighter came into the scene and hit the civilian that was helping the other civilian. In the United Kingdom, in the UK, a firefighter was charged in a fatal apparatus crash. He's accused of killing a man while responding. The man who was killed was deaf and dumb. He died when his Ford Escort was struck by a Central Scotland Fire and Rescue Service appliance. The driver was accused on a petition of causing the death by dangerous driving. More to follow on that.
Based on your experience, go back to the incident that happened in Canada, but just roll that particular experience to say if it happened in any state here in the United States. So for the people who are paid on call personnel or volunteer personnel that are responding either to the scene of the incident or to the station to staff the apparatus, when they're operating in their own private vehicle, if they get involved in any kind of accident, whether it's a property damage accident or, unfortunately, as was the case here, where there's some degree of personal injury involved, based on your experience, whose insurance is covering all of that, and where does the liability lie if you're the firefighter that's responding in a case like that?
Well, the first insurance that's going to kick in generally is the car insurance of that particular volunteer firefighter involved in the wreck. If the volunteer firefighter is injured, many states, including our state, New York here, has what's called the Volunteer Fireman's Benefit Law, which would provide financial resources for that firefighter and his family, although it be very little. But there is a financial resource there if the firefighter was hurt as a volunteer in this accident and unable to go to work. As far as the fire department and as far as the rules of litigation, when a volunteer firefighter or a call firefighter gets in a wreck like this, we are looking to sue everybody. In most states, there's a period of time, I believe in our state, New York, it's 90 days in which you have to file a notice of claim. And you have to list everyone that you believe had some degree of accountability or fault in this accident. On the 31st day, if somebody you find out through investigation is also culpable in this, because of the time limitations, they're no longer in the suit and can't be in the suit. So what the lawyers have decided to have done throughout the land is anybody that's even remotely connected with this is going to be named in a notice of claim. And then in the weeks and months after the accident, through investigation, they start weeding folks out. But what we're after here is what's called the deep pocket syndrome, where we're after those people that have any involvement in this that have money that can be paid off in a suit.
Well, that just goes to the point that when we talk about operating with due regard to the laws, and I know that's something that you've preached over and over again in your EVOC classes and in your other presentations, that sounds like it's one of those commandments that are out there. It's like, yeah, okay, sure, you know, to put their hand and swear in a Bible, do you operate your vehicle at all times with due regard to the law? Obviously, most people, citizens and firefighters as well, would say, oh, sure, absolutely. But then when you see the results of some of these unfortunate, tragic accidents in many cases, it kind of makes you wonder if the message is really getting out there. It's one thing to maybe watch court proceedings on television, and another thing, it'd be rather chilling to be sitting in there and then be knowing that you now have an attorney that's attempting to defend you because of some illegal action you took. For the folks here that are listening, we're not trying to open up this podcast on a negative note, but it certainly, I think, bears the point that having come off the recent events of the Fallen Firefighters Foundation annual ceremony here just a couple of days ago, and then you get up every morning and you read the morning press wires as to what happened in the preceding 12 or 14 hours, it does sometimes kind of make you sit back and kind of ponder if we're really doing the right stuff out there as emergency responders.
Well, and to that point, Tom, all of last year, 106 firefighters, according to the United States Fire Administration, died in the line of duty. To date, as of today, we have 98 line of duty deaths in the fire service, according to the U.S. Fire Administration, and we have 2.5 months left. So certainly, given our rate of line of duty deaths this year so far, it's not a stretch then that we're going to surpass by a lot that number of firefighters that were killed. And you and I and so many others, like the Billy Goldfeders and John Salkas and John Normans of the world, are out there preaching firefighter safety, trying to make an impact on that line of duty death number. And at times it becomes very disheartening when you see that the number just continues to go up with so many people working so hard trying to make a dent in that. And there's a financial, along with the fatality and the human side of an incident like this, there's a financial cost. A couple other headlines, Hamburg agrees to a settlement. Hamburg town officials agreed to a $250,000 settlement in a 3-year-old lawsuit alleging negligence by firefighters that they were negligently operating a fire truck that struck this person. and then a judge awards a $5.3 million settlement, which is supposed to be, in that county, the largest ever, to the parents of a girl who was just 3 days old when she was critically injured in a 2003 ambulance crash. And so there's not only a human side to this, but there's a huge financial side as well. And then the last headline, just for a minute if I may, comes out of Waterbury, Connecticut, where several months ago two apparatus collided and the officer was ejected and killed, and the driver of the pumper was trapped for some time and he was seriously injured as well. The widow of the officer that was killed, her attorney found some law in the state of Connecticut that claims that the employees had a duty to one another, so that the driver and the Waterbury, Connecticut Fire Department are being sued for the death of her husband based on that law that I don't think a lot of people necessarily knew about. It was kind of mundane and hidden. So that suit is now going forward, and inside word is that that suit has a lot of legs and may actually go to trial, and there could be a big payoff there. Even though the firefighter has the responsibility to put the seatbelt on, because of the intricacies of this law, the Waterbury Fire Department and the driver and others may be held accountable for that.
Well, every once in a while, it really does cause you, particularly with Brother Mike and myself, and just kind of take pause over what we're doing and the service that we are attempting to provide to the residents, to our customers in our respective communities. And when tragedy strikes, it generally doesn't come just knocking on your door gently. So if there's any word that we can discern or get out of some of the recent incidents and the trends of where we seem to be headed in terms of fatalities, firefighter fatalities for this year, for 2007, it's that there's certainly, I think, been a wake-up call that no one of us are immune from having something happen to us at any point when we let our guard down. And we may think that we're seasoned firefighters, well-trained, and it only takes a virtual instant or a second to have something bad happen, and then we live, unfortunately, with that for the rest of our lives. So a couple of other little news items, some things that were recently posted up on firehouse.com, apparatus-related. One, the headline read, two teens accused of stealing apparatus from a North Carolina plant. Well, one of the major manufacturers here in the country has a manufacturing plant just southeast of Rock Hill in South Carolina. And under the guise of, you can't make this story up, two boys, one aged 15 and one aged 16, decided to scale the locked, fenced-in area where fire trucks and chassis for new apparatus were being stored. And around 3:30 in the morning on a Saturday, a local resident called the county sheriff to say that they heard some loud noises coming from the property. Well, once the sheriffs investigated, they actually got involved with the chase of these two youngsters driving this piece of fire apparatus at allegedly at speeds up to 80 miles an hour, where eventually they were stopped on a four-lane limited access highway after the local police agencies put out those metal strips to take out and flatten the tires, thereby causing the vehicle eventually to come to a stop. Not surprisingly, the 15 and 16-year-olds, who were potentially probably in a little bit better physical shape, but possibly than the law enforcement people that were chasing them, led off on foot into the woods where eventually they were captured. So that kind of brings a couple of things to mind here. Let's just talk about the safety and security of unattended fire apparatus that you have in your fleet. I can remember pretty vividly the first couple of weeks after the unfortunate incidents that occurred on September 11th that many fire departments had securely locked down their stations. You could no longer drive through a community and see the apparatus bay doors up. In many cases, the fire stations became mini Fort Knoxes because of some of the fear factor that had been intruded and some of the rumors that were coming that terrorists were going to come to steal fire trucks and ambulances, load them up with explosives, and then do some damage in other communities. Well, in this particular case, I guess number one, the age of the kids who did it. I think many fire departments, particularly around this time of year, circulating around Fire Prevention Week or the month of October, where we're going in up here, at least in the Northeast, into the heating season, that many fire departments feature open houses and open up the fire stations warmly to the people in the community to show them what our capabilities are and very candidly just show off some of the proud equipment and how we operate. Well, if you think about taking that piece of fire apparatus, and let's put it maybe more in our area where we're out maybe on a pre-planning inspection or doing building inspections where everyone has left the apparatus and it's out on a public highway or in a parking lot somewhere, what candidly would prevent somebody or a deranged person or someone that doesn't have all their faculties about them, as they would say, to come in and simply open a door to fire truck, and if they can figure out how to turn on the master power switch and can initiate one or two rocker switch movements and push a button, you're off to the races, so to speak. So we want to be thinking about properly locking and securing our apparatus if it's going to be unattended, and that means beyond having lockable compartment doors so nobody could walk away with our equipment, of having locking doors on the cab. Or at the very least, which is something that is, I know, somewhat common in some major city departments, they have what they refer to as a master power switch, or was euphemistically called a kill switch. That was a hidden switch that would be underneath the dash or in some other normally inaccessible location that you'd have to know it was there, that would enable you to disable the power supply up to the starter controls to make sure that the vehicle would be safe and secure if it was out in some place where the apparatus was going to be unattended. I guess you look at it and say, well, in a career fire department, if you had sufficient staffing that you were always going to leave the driver with the vehicle, well, that's fine, so then the vehicle's not unattended. But then if you're doing a drill or some walkthrough exercise or a pre-fire planning building inspection, drivers isn't able to participate in that, and he's kind of unaware as to what the rest of the crew is doing. So you might look at it for the possible additional expense of installing some safety device like that or having lockable cab doors on your unit. Still kind of undetermined here based on this article how the 15 and 16-year-old actually powered up the vehicle, but obviously they were able to do it. Which brings you to the point with some of the other non-fire service-related incidents that have happened. This was about a week and a half ago. I think, Mike, I don't know whether you heard this or not. I was driving into work one day and said, this has got to be coming from the fiction side of the house. But this was a 10-year-old down outside of New Orleans, Louisiana, that was pulled over by the Louisiana State Trooper doing over 100 miles an hour on a limited access highway. And when he finally got pulled over and he said, what were you doing? He goes, oh, I just dropped my father off at the hospital. And he said, well, where's your mother? Oh, my mom's at work. I was driving to go see her to go eat there. She works at the local Burger King. Now, what makes that particular story even more bizarre was when the kid was further questioned in front of his mother, the mother said, oh, yeah, my 10-year-old has routinely taken my husband, who's incapacitated, to the hospital to get his medication and doctor visits because I'm busy working. Now, we're pretty screwed up in a lot of parts of the United States, but even here in the great Empire State of New York, you need to be 16 to get a learner's permit and to start to learn to drive. This kid, they admitted down in Louisiana, was routinely doing this at age 10 and driving the family truckster, which I assume probably looked like something out of one of the Chevy Chase vacation segments, I'm sure. So probably shouldn't come to a surprise to us that a 15 or 16-year-old could figure out how to go steal a fire truck. But as they would say, stranger things have happened. Mike, I know in the Bronx, when you guys go out to do your building inspections, or as I've observed, it's building inspection together with getting an Italian ice or a latte occasionally, you routinely leave somebody back with the vehicle. Is that correct?
Yeah, the vehicle is watched generally all the time. We don't have the sophisticated kill switches that you spoke of earlier, but all the engines and trucks, even at the scene of a fire, the engine company chauffeurs stay with the rig all the time. We could have a five-alarm assignment going on, and one thing's for certain in New York City is that each of the engine companies will be on a hydrant, even if it's five or six blocks away, and the engine chauffeur will be with the apparatus. With the aerial apparatus, that's a little bit different, but generally the aerial apparatus are pulled into the block where incident commanders and chief's aides and others can watch them as well. So we're very security conscious due to the fact of 9/11. All of the apparatus actually have barcodes that can be scanned, and there's a lot of other security things that have taken place within our job to keep track of the apparatus.
Well, as you can hear for the listeners, whether you unfortunately forget to possibly set the parking brake or certainly use wheel chocks, bad things can happen, and you find out your fire truck rolls out into the local pond and it gets a little hard to go cover that one up. Even if the fire truck has not been delivered to the community that it was bound to go to, you would ostensibly think that a vehicle behind a chain link fence that was properly barred and secured would keep folks out from doing bad things. Well, again, I'm just amazed. 15 and 16-year-old not only figured out how to scale the fence, how to ram the fence, how to start the fire truck, and then were good enough drivers that, according to this, there must have been some fire truck, Mike. We got to find out where this was going, because allegedly the police said it was going 80 miles an hour. That's pretty good for your first time out driver training there, don't you think?
Yeah, that sounds like the ultimate road rocket. And I understand from that that these kids actually took the truck and either rammed the fence or attached it to the fence and pulled it apart so they could get out of the compound.
Obviously, they were pretty astute at their caper. Again, the article went on to say that the total damage, fortunately, the fire truck wasn't severely damaged, because the total amount of damage from the incident was $8,000, which, if those metal spike strips took out all six of the tires on the vehicle, there's a fair amount of price right there in replacing six good steel-belted radial tires. But, again, pretty amazing. So for the folks out there, as they say, we need to keep our wits about us at all times. One of the last little news items, again, this was up on firehouse.com, and this just, I don't know whether I'm more amazed or letting my Irish Scotch temper just say I am enraged by the fact that a fire department and an organization that could get treated like this. But the community is up in, I'm hoping I'm pronouncing it correctly, but up in Barre, Massachusetts, which is just northwest of Worcester. The fire department up there, under a very good administration, operating two stations, a total, I think, four engines, a truck, and a rescue. And, Mike, this is my little gift to you in talking about ladder companies here today. This poor department is operating a 1968 Maxim open cab S model. For those folks that aren't even familiar that Maxim was a fire truck builder, they were pretty active in a very well-respected and well-known apparatus builder from the 20s up until the early 1990s when they went out of business. And located in Middleboro, Massachusetts, they built a lot of fire trucks for the Massachusetts and New England area. At any rate, this department from Barre is operating a 1968 Maxim ladder truck that they bought used from another community. And the fire chief up there had been lobbying to get sufficient funding to get a newer used ladder truck. He realized that a new truck apparently was out of the question, and according to the article, had won two-thirds voter approval back earlier this year to spend up to $375,000 to acquire a used ladder truck. Well, lo and behold, when the vote actually went to the people in the community back in early September, 58% of the people casting ballots said no on the ballot. We're operating a 1968 vehicle, which by any stretch of the imagination, even in the eyes of SPANFA, is legitimately an antique at 39 years of age. And this poor fire department couldn't get the backing of the local community to fund a used ladder truck to replace something that's 39 years old. I don't even know how you would go to approach that. The fire chief in Barre, together with a couple of other adjacent communities that also were in similar dire straits with their aged aerials, were actually thinking about possibly just going in together and getting a vehicle that could be shared among the communities, yet there's a fair amount of distance between the communities of Barre, Spencer, and Warren. So I guess a couple of things come to mind. One is that with respect to the age of our apparatus, where we in the fire service historically have gotten enamored or worked around the fact that we consider a 20-year age limit for first-line service on fire trucks, that when we get out in the public domain, they don't have any concept or appreciation for the age of a unit relative to its technical competency or the ability, even something as simple, to get parts. Again, not to diminish this situation, Maxim built a very, very fine fire truck in its time. My hometown in southern New York operated a Maxim 100-foot midship ladder for a good number of years, and that went on to a second home down in Pennsylvania where it served down there for another 12 or 15 years, and they just recently bought it back, and a member of the fire company is going to restore it. So when the company has not been in business for the last 10 or 12 years, I mean, where are you getting parts if something happens to the aerial itself? Where are you going to get hydraulic system parts, or if you need to get a shiv wheel or cabling for the ladder? Yeah, you're probably going to find it eventually, and it's going to cost you a lot of money.
Tom, this is something that just really fries me as I tour the country and teach my classes. It's particularly rampant in the Northeast, where we have 30 and 40-year-old ladder trucks that are still in frontline service, and yet you look in those same communities and the DPW and the police officers aren't riding around in 30-year-old police cars or 30-year-old snowplows. It's really very disconcerting. The fire service just doesn't seem to have the resources in the U.S., at least in some corners. The fire service is almost mirroring the general population as it relates to this, where we've become the haves and the have-nots. Either you have the financial resources to run the operation properly, or you simply do not, and then going to overburdened taxpayers trying to get some of this money is a challenge at time, as you just related up there in Massachusetts. It's very, very sad. And then to know that this Sunday, in some corners of the United States, that firefighters are going to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and go flip pancakes on a Sunday morning to get enough funds in a fundraiser to buy fuel for the trucks for the next week. It's just almost ludicrous when we provide such a valuable emergency service and just don't get the proper funding.
To that point, Mike, you can say, yeah, okay, well, if these people, somebody may wave the magic wand and there was some outside benefactor that just dropped a couple $100,000 on the community, the problem goes away. Or I think as great as it is that the federal government has finally realized that we in the fire service have been largely underfunded for many, many years, that there are numerous grant programs available to assist and offset some of the expenditures of some of these major capital items in the fire department. The other sad part is to think that eventually that money's going to dry up, or it's going to become more difficult to get those funds. For the line of work that I do in working with communities to design apparatus, it is extremely disconcerting to work with people and you find out, well, what's going to be your funding source when we get done to develop the specifications? And they'll tell you, oh, well, we're applying for a grant. Well, do you have any money set aside, or do you have a capital reserve account? No. And they're just hoping that Uncle Sam's going to ride in on the white horse, drop a check on them for a couple hundred K, and they're off and running, and then they can go buy a fire truck. And then when that doesn't happen, everybody's hopes get dashed, or they say, well, we're going to try again next year and see if we can get some money at that point. Well, that's great, but meanwhile, if in the, particularly in this case, in the case of a ladder truck, if you didn't have it or the one you had failed and it's the only one you own, what do? You hope for the next 12, 14, 16, or 20 months that you don't have any significant fires above the third story that you can hit with a ground ladder, or that if you have three or four story apartments or condos in your area that all your fires for the next year and a half are going to be first floor fires? My heart goes out to a department like this. And this is maybe a little bit unique in Massachusetts and some of the New England communities where the funding streams for the fire department are a matter of public record. And everybody, as Michael and I have experienced in working with some of these communities up there, anybody that's a taxpayer can show up at the budget meeting and can question anything in the budget. And to go to Mike's point, it's absolutely true. I doubt that too many people would stand up to the local police chief and tell him that they thought his 1991 Ford Crown Vic police cruiser was just fine, and if he didn't like it, maybe he could use it as a take-home car. But they wouldn't think twice about, in this community, of telling the poor fire chief in Barry that your 1968 open cab Maxim with the convertible top looks just fine to us, just keep running it. It's almost like a double standard. And I guess just the final thing on this. This to me brings up where we in the fire service maybe can do a little bit more to help our other local brother and sister departments. I know there's a number of departments in the country that have adopted another smaller, lesser funded department, and in many cases they will graciously pass on used turnout gear, hose, breathing apparatus, and things to allow these departments to operate at a safer and more efficient level. Well, this is maybe stepping it up one, but there's still an awful lot of departments in the country, particularly here out east, where departments are very well funded, largely funded by the property owners. They're completely tax supported and have the ability to roll over and turn over their apparatus fleet every 8, 10, 12 years, certainly maybe 15 years. Well, if you look at, here's this poor department up in Mass running a 39-year-old ladder truck, it sure would be nice if somebody would step up to the plate and say, hey, look, you know, we've got a 16-year-old ladder truck here that we're thinking of getting rid of, and how much they got, quote, for a trade-in value was not a real big deal. So rather than go selling it to a broker, not that Michael and I are against those people, that's the American way to buy a used fire truck, fix it up, make sure it's safe. In the case of an aerial ladder truck, make sure it's been tested by an outside independent testing company and it can be certified and to be safe to be used. And instead of going that route so that somebody can make money on it, still make sure that vehicle is safe, but think about passing it on at a nominal sum to a smaller department that is really, truly in need. And I think for our listeners out there, no matter where you are and no matter how well-funded or underfunded you think your department or your organization might be, I can assure you there is somebody that is needier than you or that has less money to operate and fund all of their major capital expenditures than your department does. It was a rather stark realization to me. Back in late August, early September, I was out traveling on business, stopped in one fire station where their newest frontline unit was a 2000-2001, and then everything else they had was 1986 or older, and they had that rig rehabbed, and in fact they were very proud of those particular units, and you could tell the department had a lot of strong morale and was doing a good job on very limited funding. The next community up the road where I happened to nose print the fire station and stop in and take a look and see what they had, their oldest rig was a 1999 and their newest was a 2007, and they had another unit on order. And I'm kind of scratching my head saying, wow, what transpired in that last 8 miles? Those poor guys down the road were still operating in a 20s vintage fire station, old rigs, although they were well maintained, and which is even more important given some of the things we've spoken about so far today. And then the next department up the road, they're telling me, oh yeah, our reserve rig's a 1999, you know, and they looked at that like that was the red-headed stepchild of the fleet. Yeah, we don't really like that rig too much, but, you know, we'll put it in service when we have to. And I said it was a pretty diverse representation of what can happen, and in this case, it was literally 8 miles up the road. But what happens is you go from one community to the other and find out where people understand and appreciate the emergency services that the fire department and the fire service at large provides, and is willing to support the department to allow them to do what they need to do to provide that service at a safe and very efficient level. And when
you mentioned before, Tom, about rehabs, that one department did a rehab, and then we have this other department that's in great need with a 30-some-year-old ladder truck. I think maybe that we need to explore for our listeners what are good apparatus to rehab and what may not be good apparatus to rehab, particularly, like you said, as it relates to getting parts and manufacturers that may actually be out of business. But before we get to that, we need to take a short break. This is the Apparatus Architects on Firehouse.com.
With less money and fewer firefighters, departments have to use their people in the smartest and safest ways. So the next time you're speccing an apparatus, think manual and remote control monitors. Why, TFT practically reinvented radio frequency handheld controls for monitors, flowing from 15 up to 2,000 gallons per minute. Since every firefighter counts, so does every purchase. We can help maximize your team's Firestream's performance today. Visit us at www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686.
Welcome back to the Apparatus Architects here on radio at firehouse.com. Mike and Tom, thank you very much. There's a lot of very interesting information. And like you said earlier, you know, some departments are fortunate, and you go down the block, and the next department has the bare minimum to get the job done. Second string equipment, I guess, is the best way to say it. Everybody listening, thank you very much. And if you have any questions or comments for Tom and Mike, please do send us an email to podcast@firehouse.com, and we'll make sure that we get the questions answered on the next show. Let's go back into the show and see what else is going on in the apparatus industry these days.
All right. Some people, I think, need to really consider and think about rehabs before they actually go out and attempt to do them. Some of them just absolutely become disasters. They get way over budget, and the projects probably should have not even been started to begin with based on the truck that they're trying to rehab. What do you think about that, Tom?
I guess your department or an organization considering a rehab, you're only over on that side of the playing field because, candidly, you don't have enough money to go buy a new rig. So while it's not to be looked down upon, in most cases, a rehab, it's a make the best of a bad situation type scenario. And by that, I mean if you're going to go in to consider rehabilitating a piece of apparatus, a couple of things need to go through your mind. Number one, and this seems kind of strange, but here it is. If you're going to rehab a piece of apparatus, no matter how much money you have available to throw at the project, you need to ask yourself two things. Number one, how many years do I want to get out of the vehicle at the end of whatever we do?
You mean you don't want to put $100,000 into this and then sell it the next year?
No.
How often have you seen that, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of times people, and again, be critical of where my background is, and in the volunteer service, you make people feel good if you have something new coming in the door or you're trying to rejuvenate something. So the concept is, well, let's take this as an extreme example, but this is pretty practical. Your department had a particular paint scheme a number of years ago, and the last three new vehicles coming in the door, you changed your paint scheme. I guess the most common one, very candidly, you had the god-awful lime green rig or lime green over white, and your department now has gone to a more traditional white over red paint scheme, and you've got some pretty unique graphics on your rigs. Well, now you've got this kind of ugly duckling out there that doesn't look like the rest of the fleet. It's not really that old. You can't justify replacing it, so you decide, we're going to just slam a coat of paint on this thing and go to LED warning lights and do a few things, and $80,000, $90,000 later, voila, we're there. Well, if that rig's up on the replacement schedule, and you have a replacement schedule, and it's set to be replaced in 2 to 3 years, to throw an $80,000 to $90,000 at it simply just to change the color scheme, you know, now if you're trying to do things for safety upgrades, we're all for that. If you're in a situation that you've got a pre-1991 vehicle that was not a four-door enclosed cab and didn't have a lot of the safety-related component items that were integrated into the 1901 standard at that time, now you're in a completely different scenario. But that also begs the point that if, for example, you're looking at spending more than, say, $130,000 to $140,000 on a pre-1991 unit, you may be much better off, even though that could be the pride of the fleet, to look at replacing that unit with a newer used unit that is closer to compliance with the current NFPA standards, or presents itself as a good candidate to make it easier to bring it up to the current 1901 standards. In the 1901 standard, there's an Annex D, which is excellent in how it's laid out, to take you through some of the thought processes of what you need to be thinking about if you're going to rehab a piece of apparatus. To go back to the scenario we had up in Massachusetts, it was fairly common up in New England where people had an older piece of aerial equipment, and many times this was related to the fact that the vehicle had to fit into an older station, which where they had a limitation on the overall height of the door, and it was somewhat common to take their 85 or 100-foot midship aerial off the older cabin chassis, put it on a newer cabin chassis, and drop it on there with maybe some new compartmentation and upgrade the hydraulic system, and they had the ability of saying, okay, ostensibly we got a brand new ladder truck here on a new cabin chassis, and by the way, most importantly, it fits the firehouse. If you're in that kind of situation, you want to get some advice to make sure you're doing all of the right things to meet the benchmarks on the NFPA standard, but that's a different situation. A couple of other just general barometers. If you're in a situation where you don't have enough funds to buy the new vehicle, but you feel you have enough money to do a reasonable rehab project, you generally don't want to spend more than 50 to 55% of the cost of the new unit during the rehab, unless the rehab is going to get you an extended period of time of life service that you would go out to be able, for example, to get another 10 to 15 years over this. Now, rehabs were much more common during the decade of the 90s when people were running around in canopy cab rigs, were trying to play catch-up to the NFPA standard, and then close the cabs, in many cases having to upgrade front axle, upgrade warning lights, get the reflective material on the body sides, replace body components that had rusted out. If we look at for the last certainly 8 to 10 years, the majority of fire apparatus in this country is built out of aluminum or stainless steel, in most cases non-ferrous materials, so the body rot and deterioration that we experienced during the decade of the 80s and 90s, in some cases it's still there, but by and large the industry has addressed a lot of those issues so that the compartmentation is not the issue. The issue might be that the vehicle no longer fits the mission of the department, or you find yourself that you don't have the resources financially to buy a brand new rig, and it's causing you to look at that rig that's no longer meeting your needs and say, well, what are we going to have to do to, you know, what you don't want to do is just say, well, let's just throw some money at this project and just kind of like Band-Aid it along. If that's the position you're in, okay, you know, you can't change your lot in life there, but that does mean you need to get some outside expertise or at least guidance as to what to do.
Hey, Tom, don't want to chase good money after bad. In your experience, how many of these rehab projects have come within the budget of the project when the budget was first established for the project and had enough money at the end of the day to be able to do it without being over budget?
Well, that's a good question, Mike. That's where you need to contact a reputable builder or remanufacturer of fire trucks to help you establish the budget of where you're going to be. Two sides of the coin here. If you develop the specifications properly and if you get outside guidance as to what needs to be done beyond what you see from the naked eye, as to what it's going to take, if somebody comes back to you and says, we're only looking to get 3 years more reserve service out of the rig, that connotates a certain course of action. That is very different than if you went into a community and it was their second-line pumper and the chief said, Tom, whatever we do, we need to get another 10 years front line and 5 years reserve. So I need to get 15 more years out of this vehicle. That connotates another whole different course of action and obviously funding levels. So if you go into it with the proper advice up front, you shouldn't have any surprises at the end of the show. If, however,
Tom, that we should stay away from, for instance, maybe it wouldn't be in anybody's best interest to try to rehab a truck that's no longer manufactured or that the manufacturer is now out of business. Would that be a good rule of thumb?
Well, yeah, there's one. I mean, fortunately, over the course of the last several years or the decade since we entered the new millennium in 2000, there's been relatively few manufacturers that went out of business. Between 1985 and the early 1990s, 1991, 1992, there were a whole host of manufacturers that went out of business. And again, this is not to demean any of these builders. They built a great vehicle in their day. But for example, if the vehicle you operate or own is on a duplex cab and chassis, a PEMFAB cab and chassis, both of those builders have been out of business for a while. Parts are a little bit difficult to acquire. If you have an aerial ladder device, and it happens to be one that was built by the aforementioned, we mentioned about Maxim, certainly Peter Persch, there's not too many of them out there anymore, Hahn with their FireSpire design, all of those companies have been out of business for well over 12 to 15 years. It's going to be extremely difficult to go find parts for those. So if any one of the major builders has been out of business, chassis or if it was happens to be an aerial, it's going to get to be pretty difficult to access good quality parts that you're going to be able to get at a reasonable price on that. if you're talking about rehab and a pumper, the chassis builder is still a manufacturer that's in business, and whether it has a Darley, a Waterous, or a Hale pump, pump parts might not be, quote, cheap. In other words, they're going to cost some money, but they're available. They may take you a little while to get, but it's not something that's going to be, in general, impossible to get. So you need to look at almost like qualifying the vehicle as saying, is this a candidate to look at for rehabilitation, or am I better off, as we've mentioned, let's cut our losses here, we're going to go buy a newer used vehicle. You know, if you have, even say, for example, a 1992, we'll wrap up on rehabs with this. If you have a 1992 vehicle and you talk to your local apparatus builder and he's giving you, throwing around a figure saying, hey, to do this right with everything you want to do, we're looking at probably a budget between $160,000 and $180,000 going in. Well, that's a fair sum of money. You're beginning to approach the point at which, if you're going to go be buying a new Class A pumper where you're going to be putting a bunch of different components on it, you could be pushing that 50% benchmark that we mentioned. Well, again, if the scenario is you need to get a couple years out of this vehicle, it's probably not worthwhile sinking that kind of money into it if that's the best you can do. If you have that vehicle and it is a frontline piece of apparatus and there's no hope because of the funding stream going down line to go replace that with a new vehicle, then you would be well apprised to say, well, let at least take the couple of months that it may take to go out and go look on the used vehicle market and maybe find a vehicle that's 5, 7, 8 years newer than the vehicle that you own that would be completely NFPA compliant, in pretty good shape, that has a good maintenance record, and something that you can get some service life out of. Again, depends upon your particular situation. Major city departments generally don't do rehabilitations because they don't pay for themselves, because their fleet is so large they need to buy a certain number of brand new units every year to keep the fleet current. Rehabs much more impact the smaller departments that have modest sized fleets, where you have to make these hard decisions or where unexpected repairs come out that kind of wipe out your maintenance budget. If you lose a pump or you lose a significant components on an aerial device, particularly on towers, which tend to be much more expensive to maintain, and all of a sudden you find out, wow, there went my capital reserve money. I just had to throw into fleet maintenance to keep everything out on the street. And in a lot of cases today, that's where we're at. There's not too many fleet managers that will be able to tout to say, oh yeah, I'm consistently under budget for what they had planned on spending to keep these larger size fleets up on the street. So we're going to finish up today with talking about a subject, and this really came in from a couple of comments on previous podcasts that Michael and I have done, and the question is really short and sweet, and it is, do we really need that 10-man, or to be politically correct, that 10-person cab? So I'll open it up with this little comment, and then we'll let Mike amplify on some of the things that he has been working on with other folks with respect to how big our firefighters actually are, not just by classifying them by saying, I have a 2-person cab, I have a 4-person cab, I have seating for 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, pick a number. If you go back prior to 1984, there really was no such thing as a 10-person, or back in the day, a 10-man cab. Some of the earlier apparatus builders were building 4-door cabs back then, but when we had the engine back in a conventional where it was a canopy cab, we went from a 4-person canopy cab, and people very often, even though the cab physically had 4 doors, the common fire service top terminology was, we got a 6-man cab, indicating there were 6 seats that you could put a live living body there that would hopefully do something once you arrived at the scene of the incident. Well, a combination of 2 different manufacturers that were taking different approaches at the time designed cabs and chassis that took the engine out of what was the canopy area where the jump seat, or if you were a Maryland guy, it was the bucket, all right, where you were riding, and pushed the engine up front in between the driver and the officer. Now today, that's pretty much common fare, but back in the early 80s, that was a radical departure from fire truck cab design. Once the engine got pushed up in front between the driver and the officer, that left all this space back here inside our enclosed cab or box area with the four doors, and enter the fact that now we could put more seats back there. So it didn't take too long for people to recognize, wow, you know, you put six seats back here, you could still hold a square dance back here, put a refrigerator back here, half a set of truck company tools. People started putting more seats and subsequently more SCBA seats back in there. So it was between 1983 and 1984 that the two companies produced the first true 10-man or 10-person cabs in the fire apparatus industry. Now we fast forward to where we are today. The engine's still up in front. We have departments that will say, still use that expression, I want an 8-man cab, I want an 8-person cab or a 10-person cab. And really what they're telling you, some cases, is that we don't want to put 10 seats in there. We just want, depending on what manufacturer they're talking to, we want the biggest cab you build. In other words, we want the longest cab front to rear. If you take that dimension from the center line of the front axle to the back of where the cab stops, whether it's 80 inches or 82 or 86, 88, whatever you build, we want physically the biggest cab possible. Okay, well, that solves one issue, because if you have rear-facing seats and forward-facing seats, anybody that's ever seen Brother Mike and myself when we're out instructing, even if you put our little bodies in turnout gear, we're still, at least myself, a little bit reminiscent of looking like the Michelin Man, but we're not all that physically that big. You take somebody that's 6 foot, 2, 6 foot 4, put them in bunker gear and put them inside one of these 8 or 10 person cabs, they fill up a lot of space rather quickly. So if you got a forward facing seat and a rear facing seat, you don't want these guys having to be interlocking legs or knees or hitting one another. The bigger issue, folks, comes with respect to the width, your width over your shoulders. And this is where, no matter who you buy your fire truck from, if you're trying to put more than 3 people across either individual seats or a bench seat facing forward or facing rearward, just about everybody in the apparatus industry, their exterior dimension on the cab, if you took a tape measure and went from outside cab sheet metal to outside cab sheet metal, somewhere between 94 to 98 inches. It varies a little bit depending upon each builder. So once you take that same tape measure and measure the inside room in the cab, if you were trying to put something that was a single device that was long in there, you end up with anywhere on the low side of 84, 85 inches in width. In some cases, you end up with cabs about as wide as 91 or 92. Now, that sounds like, geez, if I have 92 inches interior width, Tom, I can do a lot of stuff there. Well, you take your 92-inch width and say you want to put 4 seats in there, that means over the shoulders or at the hips, you got 23 inches per person to sit them on that seat. That's, listeners, where you run into problems, is that the manufacturer can tout, oh yes, at this point in time, we can legally put 2, 3, or 4 seats on that individual seat rise or mounted on a platform. But when you only have 22 to 23 inches, here's what I would challenge you to do. The next time you're sitting around your station, all right, and you're about to embark on an apparatus committee meeting, get an average-sized person. Don't take the guy who looks like a Smurf, and don't take the guy that's 6'6" that looks like he could be a linebacker for one of the NFL teams. Take one of your average firefighters so you don't skew it one way or the other. Have him put his bunker gear on and then ask him to come back into the room and sit down. And then measure that person over the shoulders and just over his hips for sake of argument. And look at how wide, what that dimension is. Now have him do the same thing and go put his SCBA on. Or if you run any kind of other outside harnesses or belts, have him do that and go take that measurement a second time. I would wager to say in most cases that person's width is going to be at or over that 22 to 23 inch dimension. And it might be one thing to look at 10 person cabs at San Diego or to come down to Baltimore in July and hop in somebody's cab and say, okay, hey, Jimmy, Timmy, jump up in here. Everybody sits in a seat and everybody like scooches around. Oh, this is pretty comfortable. Let's try to put our seat belts on. You're in street clothes, folks. Try doing that in bunker gear, and when you get 4 people lined up shoulder to shoulder to shoulder, now envision what it's going to be like as you're trying to put your seat belts on, get into your SCBA harness, and have 4 people try to do it at the same time. You wonder why we have problems? Well, will people sell you and build you what they advertise as a 10-person cab? Absolutely. Why is that? Because it's a competitive market, and nobody wants to say, oh, we're sorry, we don't do this. But sooner, hopefully, rather than later, and sooner meaning sooner before we find that it is now regulated against us, we'll wake up to realize that 10-person cabs, in addition to adding wheelbase and length to the overall length of the vehicle, that trying to put four brother or sister firefighters shoulder to shoulder inside any manufacturer's cab, I don't care who builds it and what color you paint it, you're tight. Now, Michael, I know you've done a fair amount of work with this, with some of your research. You think, are we off the mark here, or are we somewhere close?
You hit all the points, Tom, there. First, from the manufacturing sector, he came up with proof positive that putting four seats against the back of a cab enclosure in 2007 with 2007-sized firefighters just simply mathematically does not work. Like you alluded to, if you take the average inside dimension, you said it went from a low of 84 to 85 and then up to 91 or 92. If you took the mean average of that, it would be around 89 inches, correct?
Yep, somewhere around there, yep.
Okay, and what we have proven scientifically by measuring firefighters, the first group of measurements were done by hand and were collated by Roger LaCour, who is associated with the NFPA 1901 committee in FEMA and works as an engineer for one of the major manufacturers for Pierce. Roger did a great job in putting that information together, and what we found out right away is that when we put four 2007 firefighters in bunker gear, it takes a minimum of 95 inches shoulder to shoulder to get enough room to put a seatbelt on. And so with an average of 89 inches available, we're just simply out of room. So the manufacturers can put as many seats in the back of the trucks as you're foolish enough to buy, but the reality is that it just simply doesn't work. And then we move on to the body scanning project that, just in the way of an update, we are finishing up. We're getting the last group of firefighters done, and that report should be out by the first of the year, once Jen gets done compiling the information. And there's going to be more news in that as it relates to cabs and seating and seat belts and the changes that are going to have to be made. We actually submitted some changes. Jay Gordon Routley and myself submitted some changes to the NFPA. One of them that was adopted already is that it used to be the old numbers for firefighters were 200 pounds for the firefighter that the manufacturer would have to allow, and 50 pounds for his or her bunker gear. That has now been increased based on the work that we've done with the anthropometric study to 250 pounds for the firefighter and, again, 50 pounds for the gear. So we've gotten their attention, and they've made that pretty significant change. And what does that mean for the trucks? Well, it means that we're just not going to be able to fit as many people as we thought we could, and the seats available may not be as many. The other thing with the 10-man cabs, many of them are raised roof cabs, and of course our opinion on that has never wavered. The only reason that you would want to have a raised roof cab is for somebody to stand up in it to try to put their gear on. Well, if you follow the NFPA rules, it says that the driver cannot put the apparatus in any gear whatsoever until everybody is completely dressed and seated and belted in an enclosed position. Particularly when it comes to tower ladders, where you raise the roof, it actually cuts down on the usable scrub area. So you're going to see, I think, when we get done with the study in the next couple of years, you're going to see big changes in the cab configurations and in the seating configurations within the cabs.
It's not talk to talk and demean any one of the builders or manufacturers out there that offer this product, because very candidly to the listeners, it's a public enterprise. People are in business to make money and to meet the needs of consumers. So there's not, very candidly, a manufacturer out there that doesn't offer what they would call to be a 10-man or 10-person cab. If you don't do that, there are certain areas of the country that that is all that they ask for and buy, and whether you agree with it or not, that's the price of admission. So the things to recognize is the importance is, can it be built? Will somebody build it for you? Sure. It's like a lot of other componentry or basic designs on a piece of apparatus. You probably, at least, not to be wary, but want to take notice and maybe step back that as you're meeting or interviewing prospective sales personnel and manufacturers to say, would you do this or could you do this, and you throw out whatever your idea is, be very cautious of the person that just with unanimity says yes to everything you're asking for, because chances are maybe he's kind of leading you down the wrong road. You know, the old expression was, the customer's always right. Well, the customer's always right when you're trying to consummate the sale of the apparatus if you're sitting in the apparatus salesperson's shoes. The real proof of the pudding comes when you go down and sit down at the pre-construction conference and you're now meeting with the factory personnel or the engineering team that's actually going to oversee your project, and you throw out your idea, that same idea that the salesperson said, oh, want to do it, can do it, absolutely not a problem, and the engineer gives you that little 30-degree angle cocked head look like, what the hell were you thinking? You want to make sure that the people, you know, throw out your ideas and say, hey, we're looking for some honest, valuable input here. And all you have to do to finish up our segment here today is to go to any one of the major apparatus displays and expositions and look at typically one or two vehicles that will just defy logical description for some of the things or the combinations of componentry that people put on it. And you would say, yep, you can put 12 people together, and it was pretty obvious that that was the fire truck committee design. No one ever left disappointed. Everybody got something that what they wanted on the vehicle, and the result is typically this 34 to 42 foot barge that defies description, that doesn't do anything very well. And whereas before in the past we've talked about our respective opinions between Brother Mike and myself on Quince and rescue engines and other combination units, we can follow up on that in future podcasts. That doesn't necessarily make the concept bad. What makes it, I will say, not bad, but diminishes how practical it is when you look at the examples of these vehicles where nobody was ever told no, or, geez, nice idea, but, you know, we're not going to put it on this vehicle, and we get these Morphidite units that they're built, they meet the NFPA standard, but then when you go back and take the pulse of the firefighters and the unit officers that are operating on these things and you say, how'd we do? They'll look at you very candidly, or sometimes they'll pull you off by your shoulder and, you know, kind of look around and make sure the chief or nobody else is around and go, you know, this thing's a piece of you-know-what, and it really doesn't work, and let me tell you why. It always looks good on paper, folks. The fire truck never looks big on the 11-by-17 piece of blueprint paper because it's just got dimensions on it, but once you build it and you're there for your first inspection or your final inspection, now, as they used to say, you know, you own the ranch. So, at any rate, we'd like to thank all of our listeners very much and would encourage you once again to, if you have any questions or commentary on anything that we've talked about or have something that's of concern of yours that you would like to have addressed, please send them in to the Apparatus Architects at firehouse.com, and we'll be happy to respond back to those questions or discuss them live on air. So, Michael, any last parting thoughts?
Yeah, Tom, I think it's buyer beware. You know, try and get something that can fit your budget and fit your needs without being too overly aggressive. Get something that's going to fit in the community and give good frontline service for the 20-plus years that it's intended. So for this edition of the Apparatus Architect, this is Mike Wilbur.
And Tom Shands.
Thank you very much for listening. We'll see you next month.
Help me out here. TFT has the industry's broadest line of fire suppression equipment, yet everyone thinks we're just nozzles. Sure, we've got all the fixed, selectable, and automatic handheld nozzles you'd ever want, but we also have great foam injection and application equipment, amazing manual and remote control monitors, high-flowing intake valves, and leak-proof suction hose. So if you're specking a new apparatus, go to www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686. TFT makes over 2,300 products. We're not just nozzles anymore.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to Firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.